Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Max. Coming up on the program today, Johannesburg's Cleveland massacre sparks new questions about policing, intelligence failures, and the growing power of organized crime. Gauteng's digital divide remains stubbornly entrenched, with race and income still determining who gets connected. As temperatures rise, scientists now warning that heat waves are disrupting classrooms and threatening children's ability to learn. And with the FIFA World Cup starting tonight, collectors are scrambling for everything from trading cards to memorabilia. It's Thursday, the 11th of June. The Cleveland mass shooting east of Johannesburg that left 12 people dead and at least 9 others wounded, once again shining a very harsh spotlight on violent crime, illegal mining, and also the state's ability to police some of Johannesburg's most vulnerable communities. While police say the motive remains under investigation, residents of the Jumpers informal settlement believe the attack is linked to ongoing turf wars involving illegal mining syndicates that are operating in that area. Let's discuss this in a little more detail from the Institute for Security Studies. Lizette Lancaster, a very warm welcome to you. And maybe let me start here. A mass shooting of this scale, as awful and as tragic as it is, what does it tell us, do you think, about the current state of organized crime in the province?
We are seeing that there are more of these taking place, especially since COVID. But we know that the proliferation of firearms, and we are seeing high caliber firearms, are in circulation with these gangs or organized crime groups. And that is concerning because where do they get their hands on these? You know, so for us, when we look at the quarterly crime statistics, we see that between 9 and 10% of all our murders relate to multiple murders. The number of multiple murders are normally around what they term 2 or 3 victims, but in Gauteng specifically and in parts of Western Cape, like Philippi East, we do see these types of retaliations, and very often in very similar types of environments.
Lizette, what is the conventional wisdom then about the providence of the firearms? Where are they coming from, and how easy do you think it is to source it?
It's something that we are trying to understand with organizations such as the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. So traditional convention tells us that these guns come from traditionally, especially since 1994, over the borders because of the armed conflicts that took place in many countries, including our own. So we know that there were stockpiles of firearms that were doing the rounds or that were there. We always knew in those years that many of these, because of the armed conflict we saw in the factional battles in the 90s and early 2000s, that especially mining and hostels had some stockpiles. But we've seen the erosion of those. You know, many have made it into being destroyed or destructed, and, you know, they are old. What we are seeing here is something that seems to be multiple sort of source-based. The first is that it comes still from borders, across our borders. But there are also, and we need to know this, about 502 state institutions that have about 2.2 million firearms. And we are not always sure you know, there are not proper audits of this. There are no proper databases of this. And we know that some of the firearms leak into the system through not just theft, but also robbery of these, or through corrupt means. So they are, and then of course, some of the firearms are taken out of the hand of, say, SAPS members, private security members, during altercations. But things like the AK-47s, of course, have never been state issued in this country. So those are probably cross-border weapons.
Lizette, how credible is the theory, in your opinion, that this was linked to illegal mining turf wars, as I referenced?
When we look at some of the most horrendous multiple murders that have taken place and that the police gave us information on in the past year or so, we see that almost every quarter there are incidents linked to illicit mining. These gangs we know are highly armed. Turf wars do erupt, or intergroup sort of violence. So they are well documented to take place, at least one or two of them every quarter. So given the location of it, given just the witness testimony, it is probably super likely.
Communities, though, as we well know, have been warning about violence linked to the so-called Zama Zamas for years. It does beg the question again, does it not, as to why intervention always seems to come after the bloodshed? Is it just a failure of, is it primarily a policing failure, a broader criminal justice failure, or linked to poor intelligence?
I think we have been, the issue of illegal mining have been under the radar for over two decades. We heard the first reports of these matters already in the 2000s. And I think it wasn't seen as a priority at that stage. And of course, it has just proliferated. Private security that do look at mines have been trying to stop it. There have been all sorts of private sector intervention because, of course, people shouldn't neglect, you know, once mines close. So we are seeing all these mines that are being closed. Some interventions, but these people find ways around it. And it is simply that there are so many mines that it is sometimes really difficult to police all of them. If you think about just policing priorities in general, it has become almost impossible for them to be everywhere.
And just a final one, government has deployed the military against illegal mining. It would seem, though, that this strategy is making very little measurable difference.
Yes, the Institute for Security Studies have been warning that if we do not have a coordinated effort between the SANDF and the SAPS, and that there are really good implementation plans, and also, because those are short-term interventions, one has to try and work with the communities in a very holistic way to eradicate this permanently. So the SANDF and the police have been raiding some of these communities. We've heard through media reports that this has been done in this community. But if there's no sustained presence or further stabilization, then what we might see are retaliatory type of attacks, simply because groups move in. If you arrest, and we've seen it in the Cape Flats, for example, if groups move in or people are arrested, then turf wars erupt. And it is really, really important to stabilize these areas over a prolonged period of time.
Lizette Lancaster, thank you very much indeed, from the Institute for Security Studies.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Gauteng, I don't need to tell you, is South Africa's economic powerhouse, but a new survey is suggesting its digital economy is still deeply unequal. Research by the Gauteng City Region Observatory shows that access to home internet remains sharply divided by race, by income and location, with poorer and predominantly black communities still far less connected than wealthier suburbs. Now, that all matters because internet access is no longer a luxury. It affects education, work opportunities, public services, and broad participation in the modern economy. So what do we make of the survey? I'm going to talk now to Christian Hamann, researcher at the Gauteng City Region Observatory. Christian, welcome to you. And just broadly then, how unequal is internet access in the province today? Is it getting any worse?
So first of all, just to give some background about where the information comes from, the Gauteng City Region Observatory does the quality of life survey every couple of years. And in the most recent iteration, we asked 13,700 respondents about the things that they have in their house, you know, whether it's a microwave oven, a smartphone, or then a home internet connection or a fiber home internet connection. And when we dug into this analysis, we saw that only about 46% of respondents live in households with a home internet connection, which means that 54% of the respondents in the survey don't have any home internet connection. And that already gives us a sense of how unequal this access to home internet is.
As I mentioned in my introduction, the digital divide follows race and income closely. Do you think it's about technology or simply old inequality showing up in a new form?
I think it's inequality that keeps persisting, which is quite sad given that in the post-apartheid period, internet is kind of a new thing. So it should be something that we should be able to work on in order to give access to all areas of the province and all population groups. But looking at the patterns, particularly the spatial patterns, but also how it cuts by race and income, it's definitely a legacy problem.
Let's focus on a couple of the consequences, if we can. And I want to get to job seekers and how it affects children in just a moment. But very broadly, what do you think it means for a household economically when there is no reliable internet connection in the home itself?
It has a very significant impact on the opportunities that that home can access. So access to information, access to participate in a digital economy has very significant implications. And for example, like something like digital learning, even though respondents might have smartphones, smartphones are not quite as conducive to digital learning or even remote work. So all of those opportunities, if you don't have a home internet connection and an asset that you can link to that home internet connection, then limits one's opportunities.
And the opportunities are twofold. One is it affects children's ability to study and compete with better connected learners. Fast forward a little bit, Christian, they get a bit older. They're now looking for a job. They would be locked out of opportunities because basic digital access is still unaffordable. So the long tail here really is very long.
Yes, exactly. And it has many knock-on effects, I think. I think children or young learners who are able to access information at more readily and work with that information just set themselves up to advance through different levels of education more easily and faster. And that just sets you up to access opportunities and, you know, be able to learn how you know, these digital environments work and then take up opportunities. And when it comes to employment, for example, we often look at employment as a spatial component in South Africa and in Gauteng, where certain areas is higher unemployment rates. But if you think about digital technologies and internet connections, they're able to transcend that spatial divide between where people live and where people work, if people can access, for example, remote work opportunities that might not be even located in South Africa, but abroad.
And the stark reality here, Christian, is that Gauteng talks a lot about becoming a so-called smart province. But the reality is that it can't do that while so many households remain offline.
No, it won't be able to do that because whatever you implement at a higher level will only be accessible or then benefit the 46 odd percent of households with home internet connections. And then those opportunities that then spin off from whatever the economy is building on and chasing is not accessible and within equal reach of everyone in the province.
And the problem often is that municipalities and provincial government, I imagine, treat internet access as essential infrastructure, or they should treat it as essential infrastructure, but often looking at it more as private consumer choice. You've got to change the paradigm in that respect.
Yes, and I mean that requires both the private and the public sectors to come together and help close this gap in the digital divide.
So, what should come first then? Is it cheaper data, more public Wi-Fi, better fiber expansion, or maybe better targeted support for poorer households?
I think it's probably a little bit of everything. I think the first thing is that if the private sector is the one that, for example, puts down fiber infrastructure or promotes the strength of like LTE connections, the public sector needs to help guide the private sector in where these things are necessary. Cost is also an important thing. Mobile data tends to be very expensive. Internet connections are not necessarily as expensive, but then the coverage and the accessibility is limited. And when it comes to fiber, for example, I mean, fiber is installed on the ground, on the road verges. So where those don't exist, you obviously can't put in fiber. So that means road infrastructure needs to also be developed in some areas, and that's a public sector responsibility. And then fiber connections can potentially follow.
There is a lot of work still ahead. Christian Hamann, thank you very much indeed. He's a researcher at the Gauteng City Region Observatory.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
As Southern Africa gets hotter, classrooms are becoming harder places for children to concentrate, to learn, to play, and stay well. And the warning is that extreme heat is no longer just about discomfort. It can affect attendance, cognitive performance, dehydration, fatigue, and ultimately deepen existing learning inequalities, particularly in poorer schools, I imagine, with weaker infrastructure. I want to discuss this issue now with Dr. Natasha Naidu, specialist scientist at the South African Medical Research Council. Dr. Naidu, a very warm welcome to you, and this seems to be a hidden problem. When we talk about heat waves and children, is the contention that we should be treating this as much as an education crisis as a health crisis?
Yes, it is an education crisis and a health crisis because hot classrooms affect children's health, but they also affect educational outcomes. And creating safer and more comfortable learning environments would support children's well-being and give them the best opportunity to succeed academically.
Dr. Naidu, is the danger mainly about heat exhaustion and dehydration, or are there quieter effects on concentration, on memory, and even broader behavior, do you think?
I think that discomfort is only part of the story. It's not the whole story, because as much as heat can impair concentration, it increases the risk of heat-related illness. For example, there are children who are more vulnerable to health consequences, such as those who have asthma, those who have heart conditions, and those who just have other chronic illnesses. And I think that for vulnerable children, the health consequences can be more significant. There are also infectious diseases that are exacerbated much more during high temperatures and high humidity levels, such as hand, foot, and mouth disease.
Dr. Naidu, at what point, I wonder, does heat then become unsafe for teaching and learning? And do we have clear guidance on that within the South African school system?
There is no clear guidance within the South African school system. Guidance has been given for workers. So occupational health has the ASHRAE standards, but for children, this has not been done. And we find that the impact of heat is experienced very unequally. You find that the maximum daily temperatures in urban schools are at 32 degrees Celsius, whereas in rural schools, we have found in our studies that the indoor temperatures can go as high as 42 degrees Celsius. And this is all because of the unequal infrastructure between urban and rural schools. And I feel more has to be done to have standards that are more applicable to children who are more vulnerable than adults.
Those are very alarming statistics. Is the suggestion that the poorer schools or the rural schools are hit hardest because they have less shade, poor ventilation, overcrowded classrooms, and I would imagine across the board, fewer cooling operations?
Yeah, you know, in our studies, we found that the effect of even having metal roof instead of proper tiled roofs has an effect on the temperature, the indoor temperature. The fact that rural classrooms often lack shading by trees, they lack fan cooling, and they have broken and missing ceilings in rural schools, that also contributes to hotter classrooms.
Dr. Naidu, I imagine it's also a question of priority, and one's got to ask the question whether government planning maybe is too focused on flooding and droughts while maybe ignoring the daily reality, as you're suggesting, of overheated classrooms. So we need a radical change of thinking in that respect.
Yeah, I think also that climate change, it's increasing the time that heat waves actually occur. Heat waves occur more, there are more days in a heat wave than before. They occur more often and they are more intense now. So schools are often not built to account for this increase in the way that heat waves are occurring and, you know, how intense they are. So I think that policymakers should think about school infrastructure planning. They should think more about investments in climate smart school buildings. They should think about shade, water access, heat action plans. The investments should go into the children's health, education, and future well-being, because our children are our future in this country.
And Dr. Naidu, what about immediate intervention, for instance, changing timetables or even closing during dangerous heat conditions?
Yeah, I think that schools do look for these things. I know that even in our area, schools have asked parents to bring in portable fans. And they also are very cognizant of the timetable and when sporting activities are done. But there are things that they can't help during the school day, because school has to continue. Otherwise, children are going to fall behind in their work.
And Dr. Naidu, just in conclusion and very quickly, what do you think the risk is if heat adaptation becomes something that only wealthier schools can afford?
I think that every child deserves a safe and healthy learning environment. And as South Africa faces a warmer future, I think that government and policymakers should think about adapting our schools to extreme heat, not simply about discomfort. It's about protecting all our children's health, supporting everybody's education, and investing in the country's future.
Dr. Natasha Naidu is a specialist scientist at the South African Medical Research Council. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
With the 2026 FIFA World Cup now firmly underway, the commercial action is no longer about jerseys, scarves, and sponsorship boards, obviously all important. But a new collectibles economy is building around the tournament, driven by blind box toys, rare figures, unboxing videos, social media hype, and repeat buying. Now, Zuru says FIFA ballers are part of a wider shift in sports merchandising, where younger fans just don't want to support a team. They want to collect, trade, display, and share the experience. In conversation now with Glenn Ambrose, country manager at the toy company Zuru. Glenn, a very warm welcome to you. So is this about football fandom, or do you think it maybe is just clever retail psychology wrapped up in World Cup branding?
I think to answer your question, it's a little bit of both. There's definitely a lot of the fandom that's involved, and FIFA is a huge brand that's always going to dominate during a World Cup year. And it's a bit of a mix between the fans that are existing and they're looking for FIFA items, and then younger consumers that are brought into the FIFA excitement by a product such as FIFA Ballers.
Now, you're going to tell me, Glenn, what a blind box collectible is. Then I hope you're going to tell me why they have become so powerful in sports merchandising.
Sure. So a blind box is basically an item that you don't know which exact item you're actually going to open. So you've got a brand or a theme, and you purchase an item, and within that theme, there'll be multiple different characters. So like with FIFA, obviously, we've got a lot of the football players. There's three characters from each team. And when you buy a FIFA Ballers capsule, you don't know which player you're actually going to get. What that does is it creates a lot of excitement around the unboxing, and it also creates collectability. So the consumer needs to go back to that retail store and continually collect the different capsules to get the players they want, or to build their whole collection out if they are an avid collector.
And it's really clever from a psychological perspective, because human nature is the urge to collect, and you want to complete the collection, and therein lies the exchange of money.
Exactly. And I mean, that's becoming more and more popular. So people want to, they don't want to just buy a product anymore. They want to collect or trade or display, even share what they've got online. You mentioned TikTok. People have huge collections, and they have like a huge room full of items, either dolls or characters or anything that they're going to collect. And that just amplifies their experience.
Where do you think the line is, though, Glenn, between fun collecting and manipulating consumer behavior?
Sure, that's often a question, because we have a number of different collectibles within our range. And it's always a concern. But at Zuru, we believe that we're producing product at affordable prices. We're solving a problem for a collector that wants to get out there, wants to be able to buy numerous items and not be limited to these expensive high-end items that they can only afford one or two of.
And that's a real problem. It does, for many fans, come down to affordability, doesn't it?
Definitely. It always does. And again, one of our main strengths is being able to produce product at affordable prices. A lot of our competitors have collectibles that are well over the 500 Rand mark. We always aim for an affordable price point, and that also allows you to be successful or not.
And what's the customer profile? How much of this boom, Glenn, is being driven by Gen Z and even younger millennials who want to share something, but they also want to participate in the process online, I imagine?
A lot of it is being, the Gen Z and the younger millennials are growing the category substantially. But there is even the older consumer that's reliving their youth, that's coming back. We've spoken previously about kidults and how they've taken over and they've grown in this toy industry drastically. I think they're up to nearly 30% globally. So there's a bit of a mix going on, but for the online trends, they're always going to come from the younger crowd. And then once those go viral, even the older consumer will get drift of it and get involved.
What's the lifespan of a collectible like this attached to an event like the World Cup that only lasts for a month?
Sure. So we've done a lot of different collectibles, and sometimes they're themed around movies. FIFA Ballers is our first one around a single tournament, because it's focused on the World Cup. Obviously, there is a longer lifespan, because the players will still play for their countries. They'll still play for their clubs. So they'll still have a lot of following. So it'll be interesting to see how the World Cup period affects our sales. Sales have been very strong leading up to it. We expect it to grow drastically now that the World Cup is about to hit everyone's television screens, even though it's at very random hours for us. Like I said, we'll actually live and learn. Previously, we've had themes like NBA that are on our third series, and that has done very well, even in a market where basketball isn't as strong. So it'll be a very good learning curve for us, and we've got a lot planned, a lot of different sports planned in the upcoming years, and one of the most exciting is probably Formula One, which will be, again, very interesting to see how it evolves and affects our market.
Glenn, back to the World Cup. Locally, I understand Checkers has been selling more than 400 of these FIFA Ballers capsules per week across 100 stores. That tells us a lot about South African demand. But as far as the retailers are concerned, are they backing collectibles, do you think, because they build loyalty? Is it driving repeat store visits, which would keep shoppers coming back, or maybe a bit of both?
It's definitely a bit of both. So collectibles solve that, like a retail challenge is about getting consumers to come back to you again and again. So it's definitely a little bit of both. The sales that you've mentioned from Checkers were actually as early as April. So it was even before the World Cup started getting a lot of exposure. And we're expecting that to, I mean, now that all the other retailers are involved in the item, we're expecting sales to more than double that.
And looking at the particular figures, and this is a final question, is there one particular figure that will find more resonance than others? Would it obviously be a locally based player, or is there more international interest here?
Yeah, so unfortunately, we don't have actually any local players. The license that we acquired from FIFA focuses on World Cup winners. So it's only the countries that have won the World Cup that are part of our collection. And we see Messi as being the most sought after. There's three different rare options for Messi. So I think collectors are really going to be going for that character in particular.
And the fan in me says, Glenn, maybe in 4 years' time, we'll be part of that august list. Who knows?
100%.
It would be nice, wouldn't it? Glenn Ambrose, thank you very much indeed. Country manager at the toy company Zuru. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday, and we're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb. Your trusted source for business and investment insights.